Welcome to another episode of Lamp Talk, a podcast where we discuss everything from lighting philosophy and technology to set politics and the business of owning lighting gear. I'm your host, Mac from Macum. For over three decades, I have had the honor of working closely with some of the best gaffers and manufacturers in Hollywood.
You've worked with a lot of DPs before.
Oh, yeah.
Name just a couple of them.
Back in the day, I worked with a guy named Gil Hubbs, who did a lot of TV and special situations. And he ended up doing Murphy Brown for years, which, of course, I didn't do. But we did a lot of specials, detective stuff. He gave me my first break. It was on a TV movie for ABC Circle Films, and it was called California Girls. And it was with Robbie Benson, who was kind of popular from years before.
Right.
And so that was all done in Malibu, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
And then that's where you discover, as a young beginning gaffer, you know, your thoughts and if it works or not. And that's where you really discover how you start learning and if your ideas actually work and do they have time to work. Those are the things that you have to discover. Some people ask me all the time, you know, what do you do? How do you know? And I've told all the kids and the people that have been around me for a long time, you have to do it. Mm-hmm. And as you do it, then you learn it. And until then, until you're put in that position where you're making those decisions, you have to look at all the things that are given to you, a time structure. You have to look at your location. You have to look at the physical part of what you're doing, as well as what the director and the DP want to create. And I've worked with both.
So yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. Yeah. There's a lot of different type of styles of cinematographers and DPs, and the relationship with their gaffers are pretty unique, depending on their personalities or, you know, how their workflow is.
Oh, absolutely. They're all a little bit different. In the beginning, a lot of the guys want to tell you what to do. And in my case, early on, I was kind of making decisions on what to do. And then you fold in together, you find a medium. And there's three basic rules that I tell the young guys. One of them kind of still works, but it's always key to the look. So if you're doing a scene and the actress is looking camera right, that's where your key light should go. Mm. I see this mistake over and over and over again. So the three rules, you key to the look, better hot than not. And that, it's more of a film thing. Because now with the digital, it doesn't apply.
So where your talent is looking, that's where your key light should be.
That's right. Mm. Yeah. It should be on that side. Because otherwise, if the actor is looking over here, looking, let's say, camera right, and you light from the left side of the camera, you're lighting the flat side.
Oh, right.
You're not modeling correctly.
And that's a common mistake, isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But today with the LEDs, it's a little bit different look is what I'm seeing. But
right.
It's a little flatter.
You don't need as much finesse with flat lighting where we had a lot of Fresnels and it was a lot of hard light. You had to kind of make your own soft light, right?
Well, yes. You had to choose what instrument you wanted to use, what diffusion you wanted to use, and that's part of the game.
So getting back to the style of different DPs that you've worked for and you've seen in the past, you would say that some DPs are really opinionated on their lighting and others kind of just let you go and trust you?
Yeah, in the beginning. And then as you get a little more experience, then that changes. At least it changed on my journey from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And like, for instance, with Gil Hubbs, I'll mention him. He's a very good guy. And we did David Hasselhoff. We did a thing called Terror on London Bridge in Arizona in the summer. And it was nights and stuff. But you're just moving the whole time. Nobody has any choice to make too many decisions as you go. You got condors up at night around the bridge with 12K, the new 12K and 6K Fresnels in it at the time. This was in 1985, I believe it was. Not that I'm dating myself.
Now. No. That's when the 12K Fresnels first came out.
Yes. Yeah.
And who came out with the first 12K Fresnels?
I think it was Cine Mills. I believe it was.
It was Wally Mills.
Yeah. And Sunray. They were in like some kind of co-development. And I believe LTM had them too at that time.
Yeah. So, it was the big thing.
Yeah, it was the big thing. And then I remember when the 6K PAR came out, it was a big
game changer.
Yeah. I started off in the studios and started off at Disney and Universal and I was running some gangs. This is before I started to gaff, naturally. And then I became a rigging gaffer at the studio and ran the crews.
Is that Disney Studios?
Yeah, Disney Studios. I started with Disney in 73. Went to Universal, stayed there for a couple of years, became the night foreman there. And we were doing, 35, 36 shows there at that time.
Wow.
With all those stages, crazy times.
Did you like rigging?
Yeah, I did. And that's where you got a basic knowledge of what you're doing. And you get trained at the studios in those days. And then I went back to Disney and then became the foreman there of the rigging crew. And then shortly with Jim Rose and Herb Hughes, Jim Rose was really good to me and made me the foreman. A few years later, I became the assistant chief there under Herbie.
And then,
And then I stayed there till 82 and then went independent and started working for Curtis Ware, who was my good friend and gaffer. His dad was a gaffer. And he worked for Gil Hubs.
Ooh.
And then that's how I became his gaffer. After Terror on London Bridge, after we did, I probably did 12 things with Gil. And then I get a call from a guy named Charles Carell, another unique individual, great guy.
DP?
DP. And calls me, he says, Bill Selleck, Charles Carell, director of photography. Give me 6 weeks and you're out of here. And it was, I said, okay, Charlie, what is it? He says, oh, it's a TV show called Our Family Honor. And believe it or not, it had Ray Liotta in it. But he'd come in on Thursdays only, Thursday afternoon, and he made friends with me, and he wanted decent lighting. And Charlie did the first Star Trek, and he did Animal House, and then he won the Emmy for photography on Windsor War.
Oh, wow.
Which was a big.
That was a big one, yeah.
Yeah. And then I did several things with him. And then also his brother's a director.
How do you think he found out about you and got your phone number and wanted to work with you?
I believe it was from the first AD.
Mm.
Because Terror on London Bridge was done by a director named Swackhammer. Great guy, fast, super fast. I have a very good friend and co-gaffer. His name is Dan Delgado.
Oh, yes.
Great guy, love him. And he came in to do some night work.
So this was on Terror on London?
Yes, Terror on London.
And this is where you met Dan Delgado?
I met Dan back at Disney.
Okay.
Believe it or not, when I took over the department, Dan's father, Dan Delgado Sr., was our driver. He drove the forklift and the rigging crew. And Dan was in, he was in craft service at the time. And then he became 728. And then he became a best boy over at Disney. And then later on, we formed our relationship, partnership. But Dan came in that night, the first day there. He had his fancy shorts on and his nice shirt, his fancy shoes. By the time I got done with him that night,
he was
it looked like he came out of a coal mine for a couple weeks. So and we laugh about it. And then I had Mike Laws and Jimmy Crawford.
Oh, wow. And legends.
Yeah. And then Dan went on to gaff, with Ward Russell and Jeffrey Kimball. He was the best boy on Top Gun and gaffer on Days of Thunder and gaffer on Last Boy Scout, Wind Talkers, lots of big films. And this is how it happens, This is how I tell the guys, it's important, everything that we do and how we do it.
Everybody's watching. They want you on the crew.
They want you, yeah. So when Charlie called me and says, Silic, give me 6 weeks and you're out of here. So I said, okay. And then so I talked to the production manager. I said, okay, so when do we start prepping? What's the rates? What's the gaffer rate, work box, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, oh, no, we're shooting on Monday. I go, it's Friday at 3:00.
Wow.
He goes, well, Charlie didn't like the gaffer on the scout. So I go, oh, boy.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Here we go. Those.
All right. And I said, so where are we shooting? We're shooting at the new Itani. We have a big stunt scene in the big lobby. And I said, okay, so let me get this right. I don't know Charlie. I don't know my crew. I've never seen the location. I don't know what equipment I have, but hell yeah, let's do it. I'm ready. Wow. Let's go.
It's ballsy.
Yeah. So
right in.
Yes. Charlie liked beautiful light. He'd come to me and he'd say, Silic, go outside for 5 minutes and then come back in here and tell me if it looks good. Because, your eyes would stop down.
Right.
And then you would kind of see how the film kind of looks. And you develop that eye.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I would go outside, wait 5 minutes, walk in and said, Charlie, looks good. Let's shoot. Go to the AD. We're ready.
Wow.
And then after that, I did a couple things with Charlie. And then he started doing other things. So after working with Charlie, I get a call from Doug Pentek
Wow.
over at Hollywood Rental.
Yeah, it's another legend.
Okay. says to me, I got a guy here that was Fraker's operator, and he's turned into a director of photography. He's starting to shoot, and I thought you'd be a good pair with him. And he says, you both don't know what you're doing, so you'll get along just fine. And you know he's right about that. Started working with Steve Iaconelli, great guy.
Was Mike Laws the best boy?
Yeah, Mike Laws was the best boy. Yeah. I call him L.A. because his last name is Laws. So, yeah, he's a great, good old boy, you know. He worked with Steve Burham a lot. He did two or three Francis Ford Coppola movies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, with Alex Skorzoff, and Steve Burham was the director of photography.
Wow.
So I took this with Steve Iaconelli, and our first thing was a thing called Penalty Phase, 1986, and it was with Peter Strauss, who had just come from big awards with Rich Man, Poor Man, I believe.
Right.
And also the director was Tony Richardson from the Tom Jones fame, the movie. And I believe the producer was Alex. I don't remember her last name, but she produced Aaron Brockovich. So anyway, we were up in Oregon. We shot that in the Dalles. That was an interesting project, a lot of courthouse. So I was in Oregon for a long time.
And what film was that again?
It's called Penalty Phase.
Penalty Phase.
Yeah, it was a TV movie. Went on to a thing called Combat High. These are really great names.
They're great.
Yeah.
Only in the 80s.
Yeah, and Combat High, believe it or not, was written by Amy Heckerling and Neil Israel, who are of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
All right. Well, fantastic memory.
Yeah. So Neil Israel was our director, and Mike Laws was with me. We went off to the big world of Missouri, and there we did Combat High. Between the tornadoes and the rain.
Combat High.
Oh, yeah. And that was a very interesting project. And then we went on, and the next project was Pals, another TV movie with big names, George C. Scott and Don Ameche.
Wow.
I had already worked with Don Ameche a little bit, but, you know, George C. Scott seems like he wouldn't be friendly, but just the opposite. He's a total pro.
Really?
Yeah. First Day comes out. He's not even done with makeup or hair. Him and Don Ameche come out, introduce themselves. Hey, Bill, if you need us to stand here to check the light, we'll do it. Makeup and hair can wait. We'll stand here and let you check it out so that when we come out, you're happy.
Wow.
And that was a nice deal because those guys would only work 8 hours a day on that.
Right.
Between the Missouri deal and the Georgia deal with Iaconelli, we did Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the TV series, which we were on for 3 or 4 months. And Neil Israel and Amy Heckerling took turns directing. So then Combat High, I finally got home. I missed most of the birthdays of my daughters, which were young.
Yeah.
And I missed Thanksgiving. Nothing like sitting around a table at Thanksgiving with a bunch of crew members.
Right.
Yeah. It's real homey, you know, especially for a guy like me. But while I'm gone, meanwhile, I had been doing some commercials with Thomas Ackerman. At a company, it was a big commercial company called GMS, and wonderful company where we'll get into that in a little bit.
Mm.
Lots of big commercials, 6 week commercials. But so I had worked with him on a lot of commercials, and it was kind of Ward Russell's contact. And when he was busy, I was getting recommendations. So I think Ward was doing a movie with Jeffrey Kimball, and this other movie came up, and my wife got a call because in those days there was no cell phones. Tom calls my wife, Chris, and said, I'd like to have Bill do a movie with me. So her first question was, is it in L.A.?
Of course.
And he said, it's all in L.A. except a week or two. And she said, he'll take it. Okay. So, of course, that movie turned out to be Beetlejuice.
Oh, wow.
Which was, you know, obviously a very interesting.
And it was probably a big difference from what you had been lighting in the past, I imagine.
I didn't feel pressured at all.
There's a lot of color in that film, and you didn't have any RGB lights, I bet.
No, RGB didn't exist. No, yeah. Not in the format that we
have. So you use this thing called gels.
Yeah, it's an old thing. You roll off this roller.
Heard of those.
Yeah, and you look at it, and you just hope everybody, when they roll it off and cut it, they mark it. So you don't get in trouble when they put the wrong gel on there, and you're in the other side of the set, and you walk in, and they're starting to roll in the wrong gels on that thing.
Right.
So we used, I believe it was 132 medium blue as our main color, which you saw in that movie, as well as all the other color. And obviously, it was a tough movie. Tim Burton was great. The producers were great. The studio was happy, but it was, you know, there was a lot of work. We were on budget, on schedule, and Burton was really happy.
What stages did you guys shoot?
At the time, it was Laird Studios, which is now Culver.
Oh, no kidding.
and they were shooting Thriller right next door.
Oh, really?
Yep, and that was a big project.
Right, Michael Jackson.
Yep, which, by the way, I've worked with, too.
Are you the one that lit his hair on fire in the Pepsi commercial?
No. Dino's on that one, yeah.
So who helped with the color palette?
It would be Tim, and it would be Tom
and
Ackerman.
Tom, yeah.
And also, I guess, Bo Welch, would the production designer, would. Yeah. They have a concept.
And they gave you a palette of colors that they wanted to work with.
You go with that base color, or whatever that would be in that case. And then we introduced lightning into it. And there was no...
Lightning strikes?
Lightning strikes in those days. We had the old scissors with the carbon sticks in it. And the more sticks you put in...
Oh, wow.
The more sticks you put in, the more pop you get, and the more generator you need to make
it. Sounds a little dangerous.
Yeah, you wear a suit and a welding mask and...
Get the lowest paid new guy.
If you put enough sticks in there, it'll pop several pieces of four out of a couple of feet off the ground.
Wow.
Yeah, and the generator, too.
And that's how you did lightning on the Beetlejuice?
No, that was one of the options.
Okay.
So because of the schedule and the way it was, Tim decided he liked a little lightning. So I had a guy, a long-term friend named Albie Fitch, because he's totally an athlete. Super strong. I said, okay, Big Al, you're going to do the lightning with Brute Arc shutter on a 12K Fresnel.
And they're not DMX. They're manual shutters.
Yeah, manual shutters. Yep. They did have remote shutters at the time, but they have a habit of overheating and not working. So the more Tim Burton saw the lightning, the more he wanted it.
Oh, great.
So what you see in the final product is...
Just all manual labor.
All manual labor. I believe we did that with an arc. And then the disappearing stuff was done by 50-50 mirrors. What that is, it's got 50% transparency and 50% reflection. It'd be like if I was looking at Mac and Tim and look like in the same room, but they're actually in identical built rooms and identically lit. I would dim Tim out and Tim would then disappear.
Oh, wow.
And that's what Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis,
right,
when they were talking, you'd make them disappear like that, just on a simple fade.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, and the orange shoes disappearing and the other things we did.
That is absolutely fascinating how much lighting played into these roles of what now is special effects and post.
Yeah.
And you had to do it live.
We did it live, yeah.
That's just a higher level of craft, I think, right, Tim? I mean, today, you know, there's
you press a button.
You press buttons, right?
Kids don't know.
And you hear these guys are creating effect with lighting on the fly.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those films where, you know, we played basketball and football outside with Alec Baldwin. And every time Keaton would come in, my guys would be yelling, you know, it'd be juice, juice, juice. And they'd all high five. So it was one of those type of...
Oh, what a fun
set.
One of
those type of feelings, yeah.
What a great project.
Obviously, everybody knows about that movie.
Yep, it's a classic.
And everybody loves it. It is a thing that you completely create. You know, you use the gel, but you create the color. You create the look. That's part of something that probably is missing today.
Right. It's a little bit more sort of hands-on creativity, more of understanding the light, probably mixing gels to get different colors. So we're getting off of Beetlejuice. That's a big high for you.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the most iconic projects that you did early in your career.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's something that lasts for a long time.
And your phone must have been ringing off the hook now.
Well, at that point, we were involved with commercials in between a company called GMS, which would be Jim Giddens and then John Marshall and Skip Short, who all were great gentlemen. John Marshall always took care of me as a producer, and Skip was the executive producer. But we used to do six-week commercials. That was in between all this. I mean, Heartbeat of America, Budweiser, Coke, Fanta, and the Caribbean, all kinds of huge projects you'd be on literally for 6 weeks. A lot of light, a lot of cameras, a lot of people. After Beetlejuice, I get a call from Rich Hashimoto, who happens to be Tim Burton's producer. Something that happened at the end of Beetlejuice was, is always after they do some editing, you know, they always need to pick up some scenes.
Right.
So Tom Ackerman was doing a big cosmetic shoot And all of a sudden, a week worth or 2 weeks worth of shooting, pickup shots came up. So I went in with the operator and relit the waiting room and various other sets to match what we had done for the pickup shots. And so I get a call.
Did you write all that down for that second unit?
In my notebook, I had notes, which you always want to take, you know.
Right.
So you have color. And you may write it down yourself. You may tell the best boy or somebody. You kind of want to know your f-stop, maybe what filters the camera.
I mean, nowadays it's all digital. It's DMX, and it's easy to save.
Definitely. I still have my notebook from Beetlejuice.
Oh, I'd love to see that someday. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. So we went back in there, and I get a call like the week after, and it's Rich, and he says, I just want to let you know Tim is super happy with the way everything went, and everybody's super happy. I said, okay, great. So about 6 months later, I get a call, and it's from Rich again. He goes, hey, Bill, Tim and I were wondering if you wanted to go to Florida to do Edward Scissorhands.
Oh, wow.
And I said, well, you know, I would, but I don't know what Tom's doing. And they said, well, we already asked his permission. He said it'd be fine. And I didn't end up doing it, which I should have.
So, yeah, you already had been on the road and being the traditional type Italian man you are. Family's important. Thanksgiving's important. Yeah,
and I was doing commercials.
You're doing really great with these 6 weeks Coke commercials.
Yes, we're on a roll. In the beginning of 88, I get a call from Herb Hughes, my previous boss at Disney. He was the chief, and he goes, I've got this movie here. I want to introduce you to this cameraman, Italian cameraman. Of course, it happened to be Dante Spinotti.
Wow.
Who had just finished Manhunter, I think, with Michael Mann in the Carolinas, I think it was. So we go in, and it's a film called Beaches with Bette Midler, Barbara Hershey.
Oscar-nominated film.
Yeah, a pretty big movie again. And Dante, he liked my credits and the other stuff that he saw, and as we met, we got along great, but he mostly liked the way that I had Italian blood.
Of course. Keep it in the family.
Really, we feel like the same together. And of course, what was interesting is getting back to that style we're talking about. Some of the things that he did is what stuff that I've been wanting to do.
As far as what?
Just some of the style of a bounce slide or, you know, it's very subtle things. So we get there and everything is dimmers. In those days, plate dimmers, and you had some AC dimmers. You had to be really careful because of the sound. In those days, recording sound was a really important thing. And if you filled up a stage full of AC, your hum problem would be...
Wow, really?
Yeah.
With the harmonics.
Yes. I soon learned that this was going to go big and the work was going to be fun.
Where did you guys shoot this at?
All in L.A., Disney Studios, and then all local locations and the scenes in the beach house down in the Crystal Cove, Newport Beach.
All right.
And then we did spend 2 weeks in New York finishing it. That's where I was introduced into the Dinos, which is named after Dino De Laurentiis. And you have,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So
the Dinos were named after?
After Dino De Laurentiis, yeah.
And Dino De Laurentiis is?
The director.
The director. Yeah. And he wanted these type of lights.
And the studio. Yeah,
the studio. Mole Richardson built these lights per the request?
Well, those are Molinos, they call them.
Oh, copy. So who did the first Dinos then?
I think they mostly came out of Florida. They're referred to as Dinos, and, you know, there's 24 light, 12 light referred to as a mini Dino, but it's really a 12 light Mopar, 12 light Maxi Brute. And then there's a Jumbo, which is a 16 light, and the Dino's 24, and then the Super Jumbo would be 30 or 36. So I had got four of those out of the studio in North Carolina. And when they got to us, it was like, wow, wires
everywhere.
Very poor condition. So I knew where I was going with this right away. I could see after doing tests, it was time to call Amorelli. And then so Mike came in as a ring gaffer, and he got along with Dante. They both got along. Dante loved Mike. Both of them named Michael, you know, Amorelli and L.A. It was a boatload of work. The dolly grip is probably still getting mental help from all the cable all over the ground. We tried to put a lot of it, but he's probably still in therapy. And he's a great guy. That's just a joke, of course. But we're prepping, and Albert Brenner, who was nominated for Academy Award for the art direction on that.
Yep.
And a lot of it's the color and everything else that was all incorporated. He's got probably six or seven sets, and they're carpeted, wallpapered. They're all dressed. So we get in there. The first set we're going to do is Bette's, her modern apartment in New York, penthouse. So Dante looks at me and he goes, Billy, these men must take away all these sets. I go, okay, what do you need done, Dante? You know? Because I need the Dinos all the way on the wall.
So, oh, wow.
150 feet away.
Holy moly.
So I went to Albert Brenner and the set decorator, and I said, you guys, I'm really sorry, but...
Your beautiful dress sets.
Your beautiful dress sets. You got to fold them, fold and hold them.
And mind you, he's nominated for an Oscar on this film for set direction.
Yeah. And I said, you got to get rid of all your sets here. What? So I had already known what was coming. You know, right. That particular. Yeah. But that's just an example of
Dante.
Yes. So you have to be ready for anything.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I put the Dinos all the way against the wall, as far as I could, probably even in the fire lane.
Wow.
And put them on like 3 out of 10. Wow. So there's this warm, low glow coming up on the windows.
Wow.
And because one thing you learn is the Dinos far away is the best. They work the best. That's really? When they form.
They start to
get. The guys are afraid of the shadow. You're right. You use a certain material and you form, you can actually form a decent shadow if you need it.
It's got to travel farther away, yes. And it gets sort of parallel beams.
Yes.
And the shadow starts to get nicer.
Meanwhile, Bill Beasley was our production manager. Very fair guy, but he had to behave. And so I got called in after the first 2 weeks into production into his office and said, Bill, you're out of expendable money already. I go, well, the guy that's the Italian dude there, okay, that's what he wants. In the beginning, there was this kind of deal about budget until what I heard was Bette went to Katzenberg and to Eisner and said, I love Dante and Bill. They're making me look great. I love them. And so from that point forward.
You got your budget.
We got a little better budget.
You got your gels.
Yeah. And that was a very fun set. Gary Marshall was our director from Laverne and Shirley, Happy Days.
Yep.
So great guy, great director, really fun to be around.
I just saw the film a couple of weeks ago with my wife, really beautifully lit and shot. Surprised it wasn't nominated for Best Cinematography.
On Beaches?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It was just beautifully lit.
Yeah.
The colors, yeah. Incredible.
Our first day of shooting and we're behind schedule. We didn't get to the front of the police station. It's supposed to look like daylight. Well, guess what? You got Spinotti here. And so the rigging crews were out rigging Amorelli and everybody's out rigging another location. They all thought they were coming back and going to go home. Nope. So Scott Robinson says to me, the key grip, he goes, so what do you need? I said, everything. Take every muzz, every rag, every frame you got. Get your rigging crew, take it up. And then I got almost every light, the rigging crew, the guys. And sure enough, that's what did it. We made it look like day.
Wow.
With the Dinos and all the fill.
Holy moly.
Yeah. Probably the fourth or fifth day of shooting. Maybe it's the third day. I can't remember, but we're on stage one at Disney. I remember that. It's a scene, and this is what you have to understand about these guys, how brilliant they are. You put a light on a wall for a backlight, and when he sees it, that's it. You don't touch it. It's beautiful, and you don't touch it. So Michael Genie, who is a famous camera operator at the time, did a lot of big films. He comes over to me. He's a little shorter than me. He's looking up at me a little bit. He says, you got to move that light. That light is in Iowa. In a theater in Iowa, that light is in the shot. I go, the guy that talks Italian over there? I got to talk to him because I doubt.
That he's going to move it.
He comes over and he sees Michael Genie and he waves his finger. No, 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 no. He says, Billy and I set that light. It is beautiful. That light will never move, Michael. That will never move. Oh, and you're not used to this on our side because on the cameraman's side, it's always you accommodate. But because they're lighting masters, Vittorio Storaro and these guys, light comes first. So no, 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 Michael, that light won't. You and Gary must change your shot. And then you understand where you're at.
Mm.
And then when Dante comes down to lunch, he sits on the tailgate with my guys.
Wow.
Yeah. And has a cigar.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. We're down at Crystal Cove now scouting on a Saturday after filming all week. And it's the Crystal Cove famous house down there where the dying scene takes place. And or earlier they're friends, and it's a beautiful little beach house. And it truly is. It's truly a wonderful location. And we had already established the first day that we could light for day. So now they figure, listen, we're not going to make it. We need to make this look like daylight when we start losing light. Said, okay, very good.
Now they're spoiled.
Yeah. So then I
built make it daytime.
Yeah, right. So then I look, and we have it exactly where the sun goes down. And Dante goes to me and goes, Billy, you must put the dinos right where the sun is now, exactly where the sun is now. And I go, and I knew better than this. And I said, Dante, that's over the water. He goes, Billy, I know that. And he walked away. So, so I go to transportation and I say, I need a barge or I need amphibious unit.
Wow.
What? Yep. Need an amphibious unit. And drive that sucker right into the water with dinos on it and a generator.
Holy smokes.
And we're going to fire that thing up. And then I found out, well, the bridge into Crystal Cove wouldn't carry the amphibious military vehicle, which had, you know, tires as tall as our ceiling here.
Oh, no.
Don't know what to tell you guys, but the man wants the light in the oceans. It basically is in the surf. And I know he's never going to take it 50 feet on shore. Not going to happen.
Not Dante.
Nope. Not going to happen. No. Sun goes down there. That's where the light goes.
Holy moly.
So sure enough, they had to pay $50,000 from what I understand to build up the bridge that goes in there to carry the weight of this amphibious unit.
And you got it down.
And they did it. Oh, yeah. And then ammo. I had Scott Robinson build up a big platform on top to get the lights higher. And I put Amorelli on that thing and drove him in the water. and this is how Amorelli, excuse me, sir, the water's breaking over the front. I said, keep those things lit. Stay out there. And then Dante tried his trick where we fill the area up with a lot of smoke with the Navy foggers.
Right.
And all the light bounces off of it, and the dino penetrates, and it becomes beautiful. But when it moves too much, you can't use it. So we shot a little bit, and then we had to abandon.
Ooh.
And then we had to pick up more scenes later. Then they had to rebuild the beach house on the stage.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, where they put it on the stage, where they put it was in the middle of the stage, which, as you guys know now, it's not enough room to put the dinos.
Right, yeah. Not for Dante.
So,
and this is one of the biggest stages in Disney, too, by the way.
Right. One of the biggest stages in Hollywood. Right. It's not big enough, not far enough away to put the dino lights. So I go to the production manager. We have a meeting, and I say, we got to shoot at night because I got to put them out the door. So all transpo has to move. I have to put them right there on the loading dock of the animation, the art department. And that's what we did. We opened those doors at night. Put those dinos and finish shooting those scenes on stage.
You're kidding.
Nope. That's the kind of detail when you work with these guys, with the kind of planning and the kind of detail that you need to do.
And Dante is well respected as a DP.
Oh, yeah.
And he wanted certain look, and you just made it happen.
Beaches was a wonderful film.
Yeah.
And obviously beautifully done. That was the end, August of 88. And then 89, Tom Ackerman calls again. So we go off and do Christmas Vacation.
National Lampoon's.
Chevy Chase, yeah. And there we are. And again, Amorelli is now the best boy. But we go to Colorado. There's no snow. So they're bringing down snow. And we're shooting 11,000 feet in Breckenridge, Colorado on 4 o'clock run.
And there's supposed to be snow. There's no snow.
Very little snow. So they're moving snow from the top of the mountain.
Real snow.
Yeah, real snow.
Moving real snow.
And I go up there to see what's going on, and I'm hearing these chainsaws. So now Amorelli's up there. He's got railroad ties. He's cutting them. He's got a hairy chest. He's in his Sorel boots and his overalls with no shirt on with a chainsaw. He's cutting railroad ties to put generators. Because at the time, Jeff Beebe, which now we have the Beebe light.
Right.
He owned generators, which was bought out by Young. And he saw the Musco, and that's where I think some of the BB light. He had to fix it a couple of times up there. But I had to fight with Warner Brothers to get BB's generators on because they wanted me to use the other ones, you know, gas units. I said, I can't use gas units at 11,000 feet. They turn into nothing. They have to be turbo diesels. So anyway, Bruce Beebe went out and put all these 500-600-amp generators, four of them, I believe, on sleds. And they got pulled around up there and put into these generator pads that Ammo had built up there.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, that movie was a good movie. It was not as much fun when we were doing it, but...
It was a tough job.
It was a tough job, yeah.
How was it to work with Chevy Chase at that time?
With me, it was fine. He was a little tough.
Mm-hmm. So I heard.
Could be a little tough, but I got a Christmas card every year from her for like 10 years.
Oh, right.
After that. So that was nice. But for me, it was fine. And it was, you know, it was a lot of lighting on that picture. The back lot was all Columbia Ranch there in Burbank. So that was the 90 movie. And then the 91 movie was with Dante Spinotti again and Gary Marshall. And it was Frankie and Johnny with Pacino and Pfeiffer.
Of course, classic.
If you look at that movie, the night stuff inside has a blue-green look to it.
Right.
In order to save the studio money, I came up with a gel pack. So instead of renting a $400 light, they're renting a $100 light. But we could put gel because it had enough light. I don't remember the color today, but it was a green, blue, maybe a little bit of warmth to it or something. I'm not sure. It was blue-green combo. Mm-hmm. And the grips made all that. It was actually Albie was the ring gaffer on that, and Amarelli was the best boy.
What's Albie's real name?
Albert Fitch. Yeah, great guy. Love him. On that particular movie, we had Albie's cousin. His name is TJ. He's a good old boy from West Virginia. And so the first day we're lighting, and Dante doesn't like neutrals on the windows. So if you don't use neutrals on the windows, you got to build a light up inside for balance. So TJ calls me, and I already knew him well. Bill, just a minute. He's hanging over the greenback. Bill, I got to talk to you. I said, what do you need, TJ? I ain't got a second. He said, this old boy can throw some light. And it was Dante again. This old boy, I never seen anything like this old boy. So I've seen a lot. I've been around for years. I've seen this old boy can throw some light. I said, you haven't seen nothing yet, TJ. Anyway, those are the little things that happen.
So you didn't use HMIs on that show then?
Well, some, not
as much.
Not there. I had them outside. But I will tell you, this is how this light works. On that movie, there's some executives standing inside. Because they didn't like the money we were spending again. Outside, I had Dinos running through the windows. And it was just beautiful, you know. And they had the overhead soft stuff and Dinos coming through the windows, which basically was the open door with the facade. He says to me, he says, I didn't know the sun came around that far. I said, excuse me, sir, that's not the sun, that's us. He goes, no way. I said, sun's over there. And Amarelli's right. You need to put in this kind of equipment to make it work and keep it working.
Yeah.
So it does cost money. It's the second day. We're in the theater. Alex Rose, which is, I think, a pretty big-time producer, she said, as soon as it comes up, she goes, Dante and Bill, can you stay after, please? And we look around, and Michelle Pfeiffer's sitting right next to her. So they call us over there, and everybody leaves the room, and there's just like the four of us there. Maybe Gary Marshall was there, too. And Michelle thinks she's looking too good. So, because we didn't try to make her look that good, but it's Michelle Pfeiffer.
Right.
1991. She's beautiful.
She's really legitimately complaining that she looks too good.
Yes.
That must be a first.
Wow. Well, because she's supposed to be this waitress that.
Right. You know, and you said, it's not my fault, Michelle.
It's not my fault. When you have a beautiful flower, it's a beautiful flower. You know, you want to make Michelle Pfeiffer ugly. Okay.
Yeah. There's only so much I can do.
That's a new one. So that leads us now into the end of Frankie and Johnny. Mm. And now we've got a trip planned with my wife and other friends. We took the kids on vacation. I get a call. Billy, it's Dante. We go to North Carolina and we shoot beautiful pictures for Michael Mann. And so I go, Dot, I can't go. I've just finished
150 days of shooting. I got vacation.
Yeah. He goes, we have to shoot beautiful pictures, Billy. I said, no, I love the idea, but I can't go for a month or something. He goes, well, just send me that Amarelli fellow and you come soon. I said, okay, that sounds like a deal. So I call production, talk to the production manager, And I said, listen, in order for me to help Dante the right way is I can't go alone. And I said, you need to hire 8 people on your movie and I can make a difference. You need best boy, rig and gaffer, and myself. Then you need a key grip, best boy grip, rig and grip, and a dolly grip. It was an East Coast contract and he wouldn't do it. Wow. So I tried to make it work. And then Dante got upset with me because I knew that he would not be happy that I wasn't going to go.
Right.
And I can't go by myself. I couldn't really help him.
Right.
So I knew it was going to be miserable out there. Then we finally got together a few years later on some commercials.
Ooh.
You know, we did a Home Depot commercial. I got called in with Dante. I told the production manager that called me, you know, production coordinator, supervisor, whatever it is, commercials. I go, this is like Picasso painting a garage door. I said, you're hiring Dante
to do a Home Depot commercial.
Nothing against Home Depot, but
right.
I've tried to make those places look good, you know. And I've tried grocery store, and I've tried everything. I've tried to put solids up one side and light on the other, and light on both sides, and light, no light. It looks like a grocery store and a bunch of cans, you know, no matter what you do, almost.
Oh,
so in that particular case, it was interesting because then we hung a bunch of mirrors in Home Depot. So the guy that did, the director that did a lot of Home Depot spots wanted something. Now that we have the mall rented for Santa Claus, Christmas tree in the middle of Glendale Galleria. I know what's coming. You guys know what's coming, right? Where are we going to put the Dinos?
Where are we going to put the Dinos?
Right? I know it's coming, right? I know that I'm going to need a diaper for the location manager, you know, and a bucket. He's either going to throw up or crap his pants. Okay? The Christmas tree is down below. The camera angle's looking down in the big circle there. And I'm going, oh, boy. This guy, he's going to have to buy the mall. Sure enough, here it comes. Billy, we must have the Dinos. I said, well, in this case, Don, you know, I'll put them just back there so there's not too many stores. Oh, no, 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 Billy. Oh, no. So we put them way back down the aisle. I walk down and I go, okay, this is where it has to be, like 150 feet away. And the location manager goes, I got to buy like 20 stores. They got Spinotti here. What do you want me to tell you?
I mean, dude.
He's going to have the Dinos here. Trust me. And sure enough, they bought those stores and we put the Dinos there and put them on the ground. And
the best looking Home Depot commercial ever created.
Well, the interesting thing was something had been done to the camera before and it wasn't checked out correctly. And it was a waterfall effect for the light. And the whole commercial on film was ruined.
So no.
All Dante's stuff was never seen.
Really?
Which kind of is ironic that maybe Dante Spinotti shouldn't, nothing against that, but maybe.
That's a sign.
The artistry
from the universe,
involved.
Yeah,
I don't
know. Yeah, that's a sign from the lighting gods up above. Maybe.
Anyway, he was supposed to do Superman, and Dante was supposed to shoot it. So I get this call. All of a sudden, I get this call for Spinotti from the production manager that Dante wants me there for the tests because we're testing his cape, the color, different reds, different makeup, different pieces of set. Dante requests your presence on this test. I said, okay, well, it was like toward the end of commercial time. And I said, yeah, I could do it. It'd be a pleasure, be an honor, as always. You know, the producer knows Dante. He goes, where did Bill come from? I mean, Scott goes, well, they did movies together and they really get along. He goes, but Bill speaks Italian in lighting. So, and then the producer goes, I totally understand. That's what does it. But Dante, I guess, was just knew that when we had to have 3,200 Kelvin, and I would make sure it was 32.
Right.
And the correct f-stop. So we did like a week worth of tests. I get this other call about doing it again. And Dante requests your presence. I said, well, I'm not available. And they go, okay, well, Dante says you have to be there. So I said, really? These are tests. Oh, yeah, you have to. So we have to schedule around your schedule.
What?
Yeah. I said, oh, okay. So we did that. That was the second week. Then they did a third week. It says, Dante requests your presence there. It's December now. Dante goes to Italy, and he has a Northern Italy country home that's been in the family for a couple hundred years. Dante's not going to be there, but he wants you there. I go,
really?
Yeah. I said, really? I said, these are big tests for, okay, let's do it, Scott. You know, so those are the kind of things that happen that make you think in this world sometimes,
yeah.
You know, or yeah. You get this guy and he trusts you that much.
You speak lighting.
Yeah, I speak Italian.
Tom Ackerman.
Yes.
His style compared to Dante.
Well, it's completely different. It's more scientific than it is
feeling.
It's more professor than artist.
Right.
After Frankie and Johnny, I decided, you know what? I'm just going to make my living doing commercials. I'm going to stick with commercials. I can control it. I want to start building the company up more. Mm. And that's when Sun Lighting started getting bigger.
Why did you choose to do commercials again?
I think it was just to keep control of my life.
Right. Bit. Yeah. Because it's... You never know when these big projects and these DPs that rely on you.
I really don't like going out of town for 6 months.
Right.
And these movies I was offered were all, it was either, you know, Mexico or it was.
And you've always been a really, traditional, family-oriented Italian man.
And I didn't like living in a hotel room, you know.
Right. And you treated your business like the way. Everybody at your business was like family.
Yes, tried to treat everybody good.
Yep. And what are some of the gaffers that you used to fill in when you weren't available?
Well, you know, that was always an issue for me. I know some guys seem to be good at that, but I had a lot of trouble. Yeah, Albie would do it sometimes, Albie Fitch, and my brother George.
And Dan Delgado was off doing...
Yeah, he was off doing movies.
Movies, yeah.
Yeah. Remember, all these director cameramen they're brilliant minds. On the way they think, but they border insanity.
Sure.
Just because of who they are,
right.
And their creativity.
Yep.
Eric Saarinen's a wonderful guy. You know, his father and his grandfather were the great architects, the Saarinens, and they have a furniture line. But he became a director, and he just would want to do everything, like all of them, as good as you could. He's a super nice guy. His father is the architect on the St. Louis Arch and the TWA Center in New York.
Wow. So and Joe Pitka, he had an interesting way of...
Communicating. Oh, yeah. But like I tell everybody, I said, you can't be there with these guys. You cannot be there for the money. Only the money.
Right.
Because it'll eat you up.
That's right.
You have to be there because you like the work. The work has to come first. You have to like the brilliance of... What you're creating.
Now, what was it about Pitka? He didn't like overhead lighting, or what was that about him?
No, everything was overhead.
Light boxes all
so
the time.
So he could go anywhere with his camera. But that wasn't just him.
Yeah.
You have to light with these guys so they can have freedom of movement.
Was there any situations where you had a tough time getting in an overhead box light?
Oh, absolutely. So we're doing this Motorola commercial, and I look in here, and there's like 100 chrome toasters and 4 silver cars in too tight a spot, and they make these small windows.
You're screwed.
Exactly. So I tell Austin, I said, listen, where's Joe staying? Because he has a home at the beach. He's got the Bugsy Malone mansion in Hollywood. He's got all these, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright Jr. homes. So where is he? He says, I think he's in Hollywood. I said, well, good. I want him to stop by tomorrow morning because...
Got trouble.
So here comes, okay. So I get a call. I says, oh, I think Joe's going to be in this morning. So 10 minutes later, here comes the Bentley. He walks in, looks around, says, you're fucked. I go, I'm fucked. We're fucked. No, you're fucked. How are you going to light this? I go, well, that's why I want to talk to you, because you like to tip up. And I want to put a box right there, and there's not much room. Well, you're fucked. That's what I can tell you. So then Stevie's up in the thing starting to hang some points for me, the key grip,
right.
Some motors. And so I walk over there 25 feet this way, and I'm telling him to do this. And I turn around, and Joe's gone.
What the hell? He just took off.
Where'd he go? And I, Austin, where's Joe? I think he went to his car. I go running out there, and this car's running. Now, you got to picture this, okay? Car's running, dark windows. So what do I do? This far away, I go up and I stand like this in the window.
And you can't see him.
I can't see him. He can see me.
He's just standing there.
Maybe I can see him a little bit. I stand there. Now, this is like 3 minutes. Okay, this is not 10 seconds. I stand there like this for at least 2 minutes.
You got to get his approval on this different setup.
Yeah, so I'm staring in the window. All of a sudden, the window drops. He goes, what do you want? I said, I want to know if I can put that light box in there. I said, what do you think? He goes, you know what I think? I think that, you know, we were talking about your daughter and horses. I think that the Palominos, nobody knows if it's a color or a breed.
Oh, wow. That's what he thinks.
Okay. I'll try to find out. He goes, you know what else I think? I think you need more gel on your hair. Window goes up, late scratch, and takes off. Austin comes over and goes, this is true. This is all true. Okay. Austin comes over to me and says, hey, I see Joe was talking to you. What'd he say? I said, all I can say is I'm calling my daughter this afternoon to find out if a Palomino is a breed or a color. And I'm making sure that makeup has a little gel for me tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. And that's the truth.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Did he complain when he got back? The lighting?
No.
Loved it.
No, I loved it. We shot and that was it. But, you know, you never know when he walks in because, listen, we've walked in to shoot tiger stuff in Orlando for a scout. You fly all night, get there in the morning, go scout. And when he goes walking up, because he's a huge man, he's 6'7", 6'8", long gray hair. When I introduced Jimmy Dunford to him, I said, Jimmy, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to spend $1 million or more on this set, okay? And we're going to go see him because I want to introduce you because he hasn't met you yet. But this is what's going to happen. He's going to give me 30 seconds, and that's it. So if you need to ask a question, you need to
get it in.
Yeah, get it in. So go over to the production office in Venice. He's playing basketball with a PA. Stand there again for 2 or 3 minutes, turns around, what do you want? Make it beautiful. And I go, okay. I said, I want to introduce you to your new key grip, Jim Dunford. Oh, he says, okay, nice to meet you. And Jim says, you want a dolly? He said, yeah, give me a dolly. And I said, well, so I want to let you know what I'm doing. I says, you know, and everything. He goes, just make it beautiful. He goes, you know what I think? I think those tennis shoes don't go with those shorts. And he turns around to the PA and says, give me the ball. And that was it. And Jimmy's mouth is open like, that's it? That's what we get, this huge set. I'm putting up 150 feet by 250 to muslin. And we got 12 guys on the crew. That's it? That's it. That's what we're going to get until he shows up in the morning of the shoot.
And so for younger gaffers out there, I mean, there's a lot of great advice that you've given them over the years. You know, what do you think would probably just be like the main piece of advice that you could give young gaffers that are just starting their career?
I would say that you need to trust yourself and you can't overthink it. You don't want to overthink it because you have to go with what the set gives you. In other words, does it give you windows? What about the ceilings? Is it day? Is it night? These are all things that you have to put together.
And you got to visualize a little bit first.
And you got to visualize. And and you can prep it. And the night before, you can think about it, which you should do. One of the main things is that you don't have all the answers right away. You have your limitations. You know, they move the camera sometimes and it changes.
Changes
you
everything.
You have to float by like a butterfly and sting like a bee. You know? So you need to be flexible.
Flexible.
And try to maintain your attitude. Take what you're given naturally by the set. Hmm. Whether it's windows, like I said, whether it's doorways, and you have to adjust to that. And if you can't, you can always resort to the three things. These are the three things you got to do. Always key to the look. When in doubt, flatten out. And better hot than not.
Not.
And that the better hot than not is more of a film.
Film thing, yeah.
Because now it doesn't quite. Because
you can underexpose on digital.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of information that's taken in.
Yeah. And on film, you know, you don't see it till the next day. So you can always take it down. But if you're underexposed on film, it creates some problems.
So when in doubt, flatten out.
Yeah.
What does that mean? That's your lighting ratio?
Well, I think that when in doubt, flatten out means that if you're stuck in a corner, and you see you have an actress or an actor, you bring the light. So it's a little more...
More, and the lighting is a little bit more filled out. And so,
yeah, so if you think you're going to be creative and take the light around and it doesn't look right, then if you're in doubt of that, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Yeah. I mean, if you think it's going to look good, it might look good, but the actor might not look good, or it might not be right for the scene.
Right.
So if you follow those three rules, and the old adage is you start, like on a big set, you start in the back of the room, and you work your way forward.
And that's how you light the set.
That's how you light the set. And what I've told the other guys that have listened to is that, say you have a night exterior, sometimes you're prepping a little longer than what they want to give you or the time that you actually have. Well, the best thing to do is put up a bounce, 12 by 12 bounce all the way in the back and light a light into it. It means nothing except that
you're starting.
All the smart people above you think that you're doing good. And you've done nothing.
What a great tip.
Yeah, you've just set up a deal until you're figuring out the rest. Everybody has to remember, you don't have all the answers on all the sets all the time. You do have to figure it out. Once you get enough experience, it probably comes a little bit easier, but you really don't know until you've done it.
Yeah. Well, I've been a connoisseur of gaffers for a long time, and I got to say, one of the best in the industry. I've learned so much from you, and so many other guys have. Incredible, true scholar, true gentleman, amazing stories, amazing storyteller. Brilliant.
Thanks, Mac.
Lighting Man, thank you so much. We're going to have to have you come back.
So Mac is the man. Mighty
you know
Mac,
what? He
I
named the
him.
Company MacCam.
Yeah.
It was originally said Mac Can.
Yeah.
Mac can do anything.
He can. He still is.
That's right. Yeah, Bill Silik here, guys. Yep. Legend amongst gaffers.
Thank you for joining us today. And please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Macam Inc. or visit our website at www.macam.tv. I'm Mac from Macam, where it's easy and delightful to spend your money on the latest technology.